Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. This week, we'll hear from farm workers in Wasco. COVID-19 is disproportionately affecting Latino populations. So what protections are these essential workers given to reduce the spread of the disease? We also speak to leaders from two distinguished venues in the San Joaquin Valley, the Fox Theater in Visalia and Tower Theater in Fresno. With a ban on large gatherings and no shows on the horizon, we'll learn how these landmarks plan to endure the pandemic. But first, California Governor Gavin Newsom suspended most evictions in April. But now state lawmakers are debating whether to lift the moratorium, leaving renters who have lost their jobs to the pandemic facing an uncertain future. To learn more about how this could impact the affordable housing market and homelessness, I spoke with Fresno State Associate Professor of Sociology, Amber Crowell, and Patience Milrod, Executive Director of Central California Legal Services. Patience, can you just give us a snapshot of where things stand today as it pertains to affordable housing in the Central Valley and eviction protection in light of COVID-19?
Well, before COVID, in Fresno County alone, there was a shortage of between 35,000 and 40,000 affordable units. What that meant was people were spending 50% and more of their income, of their very low incomes, on their housing. A lot of times the housing being so substandard, you could not possibly argue they were getting their money's worth. So that was already a problem when people, before the economy tanked and people were working. So now it's worse, and I don't have any current information about how many more units we would need in order to decently and safely house people at a price point they could afford. But I feel secure in saying it's at least twice the number that it was, given how poor we already are as a region, and then beyond that, how stressed people are economically. So that's the state of affordable housing. The solution to this has always been supply. And, you know, a lot of the governments, local governments around here want to be Palo Alto. And so they resist building housing that my clients can afford to live in. So that's the state of affordable housing to the extent I can report on it at this moment. And then your other question is what protections are available?
Exactly. I mean, we've had some moratoriums on eviction, but the deadlines are coming up soon.
It's a big mess. Different governmental entities acted at different times and did different things. So there's not a uniform set of protections. Generally, though, in California, the governor has declared a state of emergency, and the Judicial Council, which is the courts of the state of California, have declared a moratorium which precludes landlords, except in the case of public health or safety, danger to public health or safety. They have precluded landlords from going to court to get an eviction. So there's a whole process. If I don't pay my rent, somebody comes in under ordinary times, knocks on my door and gives me a notice, hey, pay rent or quit. I still don't pay my rent, then they come back 3 days later and they give me a court paper, a summons and a complaint saying I have 5 days to get into court and say why the judge shouldn't just issue an order throwing me out of my house. So that judicial part of the process where the summons, which is what makes me obligated to show up in court if I'm a tenant and I'm being sued, that summons, the court will not issue it. And if the landlord cannot use the court process right now in order to get a tenant into court, in order to get that order from a judge that requires the tenant to leave their rental property, Now, that said, what we've seen at Central California Legal Services is landlords still want to get people out of there. So they end up giving people notices that, for example, supposedly require them to leave their premises, but they don't meet the requirements of the health and safety exception, or they try to file complaints in court that don't meet the requirements of the health and safety exception. And we also know that people, when they get a notice from their landlord, even if it's not from the court, they often just look at it and say, oh my God, I better get out of here, because to have an eviction judgment on my record is so damaging to my efforts to get housing later that I just need to leave and just avoid this whole process altogether. And Amber can talk really authoritatively about how prevalent that informal eviction process is. It's not a judicial process. And the protections that are available under law don't prevent that if tenants don't know their rights and don't insist on them.
Amber, can you tell us a little bit about what is happening in terms of the market? And you know, if somebody receives an eviction notice and doesn't realize that they are not legally forced to leave their home, where would they go?
Yeah, so before the pandemic, we were surveying tenants in eviction court and asking them that very question, where are you going to go? And not a single person who we spoke to had a new home lined up. They mostly said, I'm going to go sleep on my friend's couch, or I'm going to go stay with my mom, or in a lot of cases, especially when it was families with children, they were staying in hotels or motels. So that's a pretty common outcome for people who are evicted. They can't find housing in the short term because it's really hard to find housing in a county that has 40,000 unit shortfall in affordable housing. And to compound that, when you are formally evicted, it goes on your tenant record for 7 years. So they are automatically screened out of most housing in Fresno, most safe, decent housing in Fresno. When they're informally evicted, the people who are informally evicted, so people who they leave without going through the court process, either because their landlords are intimidating them or because they are, for whatever reason, can't go through the court process, say it's an undocumented family or a mixed status family, they're already in a situation where they're quite vulnerable and their options are extremely limited. So they're most likely to end up staying at other people's homes or relying on, you know, cheap motels to get by. So they are, for the most part, homeless, you know, in that sense of the word, and that they don't have a stable, long-term place to stay. That's what we were seeing happening before. And now, when the rental market has kind of frozen because people aren't leaving their units, even people who say their lease is up, you know, or they were evicted prior to, you know, they're not leaving because they don't have to. So there's an even greater shortage of available rental units because no one's moving. So if you lose your housing right now, it's extremely hard to find a new place to live.
And then once the moratorium lifts, what is the market going to look like?
The first thing we'll see is the wave of eviction filings. So right now we submitted PRA requests to the courts in the Central Valley to find out if filings are happening right now. And actually, there's very few. So if there's one good thing that the moratorium has done other than keep people housed, it's also seems to have discouraged landlords from filing for now. But renters are starting to fall behind on rent. The Census Household Pulse Survey that is keeping track of this nationwide is finding that it's getting harder and harder for people to make ends meet. They have been, because as the saying goes, the rent eats first. So they've been finding ways to do it, but all of those strategies are not sustainable. So we'll see the wave of eviction filings when the moratoriums lift, and then people will lose their housing. But what we'll also see is that mom and pop landlords, who make up the majority of landlords in Fresno, are going to fall behind on their mortgages because they can evict the tenants, but recouping that lost rent is a little harder to do, and the tenants themselves don't have the money. They would have paid it if they did. So this is where we're kind of taking lessons from the 2008 recession and what we saw there. The 2008 recession and the housing crisis associated with it resulted in a ton of middle-class families losing their homes. And in the fallout of that, we saw a massive transfer of wealth as housing went from the hands of middle-class families who were trying to establish some base amount of wealth to a small group of mostly corporate real estate entities. Mm. So we're in danger of seeing that happening again on a large scale because tenants aren't getting relief, and as a result, landlords aren't getting relief. And in Fresno, we've seen what happens. We've seen all these properties go into the hands of corporate landlords, and out of that, we've seen rents go up. We've seen the quality of housing go down, because when housing goes into the hands of corporate real estate entities, it becomes all about profit. Mom and pop landlords, they rent out housing to, you know, say, set back money for retirement, right? When corporations get a hold of those housing units, it's totally different. It's strictly about making a profit.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
So it takes us further away from housing as a basic human need and more towards housing as a commodity that, you know, companies can make money off of, which will just worsen our problem.
It just seems to me that COVID-19 has exposed the frailty of our systems. At the same time, it has also exposed our interconnectivity and how all of these issues connect and affect all of us. And so I want to bring it back to where we started the conversation, which was the crisis of affordable housing that we were experiencing and not addressing prior to COVID-19. Patience, what is your thought around the lessons that we will learn from this pending, you know, wave, as it's been described, of evictions when the moratorium lifts? Do you think that this could lead to a more substantive conversation about addressing affordable housing, period? Or are we going to go back to the status quo?
So I think it's going to be difficult to go back to the status quo no matter what. There are bills pending in the California legislature right now that would provide for a rent deferral. Also, it's really important if people can pay their rent, they should try to pay their rent, because the more you put it off, the bigger the bill is going to be at the end of the day, and the more difficult it will be to stay in your house, even if there's some kind of relief after the moratorium. So one of the thoughts is to maintain the moratorium until the end of the state of emergency, which, you know, at least, and then to divert tenants who owe a significant amount of rent into a rent deferral agreement so that they can pay off their rent, their overdue rent, little by little, and not be subject to losing their houses. So that is a really different way of doing business. It is not the, you know, I'm collecting rent every month and putting it in my pocket model. It is an accommodation based on the capacity of the tenant to pay, which is like, that's pretty inconsistent with ordinary market housing. The other thing that we're seeing people begin to talk about universal basic income. I mean, there are beginning to be fixes that we have desperately needed for a really long time so that housing could be accessible to people who are very low income. It is, local governments are hostile and developers are hostile, because when you pencil it out, the investment in affordable housing is difficult to recoup, and the tax that the local government retrieves are lower. And certainly in the Central Valley, there's a whole lot of locations where people, the populace, the citizens of the city, resist the idea of affordable housing. So Clovis is a really good example, which is why CCLS is suing them, so that they can begin to comply with the law about providing zoning and planning that would accommodate affordable housing. But that is a very long, slow process. So I was heartened to learn that the city of Fresno, for the very first time, and I've lived here 40 years, for the very first time, the city of Fresno is imposing restrictions on landlords' rent increases. So the Housing Preservation Fund that the City Council just enacted last week, I think, or the week before, in order for the landlord to receive rent from the Housing Preservation Fund so that it makes up the rent that the tenant can't pay for, the landlord has to commit to not increasing the rent. And similarly, rent increases are restricted under the state moratorium also. So there are beginning to be incursions into that market mentality. And I think what will matter is, and I think Amber's 100% right, that corporate landlords, they really only care about the bottom line. So this is a cultural problem. So to the extent housing can remain in the possession and ownership of people in the community who will benefit from tenant stability and the educational attainment their children can have and the ongoing employment and the improved mental health. And so there's a lot that happens when a family can stay in their house, and the reverse happens when they have to leave. So to the extent local people continue to own rental property and reap the benefits of tenants being able to pay for their housing, then it becomes a virtuous cycle as opposed to the reverse, which I think Amber described really well.
So Amber, we just have a minute or two before we need to wrap up, but I'd like to give you the last word. If somebody's listening to this who is potentially facing eviction as a result of job loss, what do they need to know right now to protect themselves?
So it's very important that renters know that right now, unless it's a court-ordered public safety or health issue, and it has to be court-ordered, nobody should be receiving eviction notices. Evictions are not happening. They're not being processed by the courts unless it's a public safety issue. So there are no court summons other than those few exceptions. It's also really important that renters know that the rent is not canceled or forgiven. So if they can't pay rent, okay, they need to work out some sort of repayment plan with their landlord if they can. They need to let their landlord know. But they also need to know that the moratorium does not forgive their rent. It doesn't cancel it. So somewhere down the line, it's going to come back. Now, hopefully, the state legislature will pass AB 1436, which will introduce a lot of protections and give renters more time to get back on their feet and pay off that debt. But in the meantime, that's what they need to know. So if they're getting notices, they need to call legal aid, and patients can rattle off that phone number.
Patients, please.
Right. 1-800-675-8001. 1-800-675-8001. People can also apply for assistance at our website, which is www.centralcallegal.org. CentralCallegal.org.
Well, thank you both so much for taking the time to fill us in on this complicated but deeply important matter. So thank you.
Thanks for your interest.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Performing arts venues have been dark since the coronavirus pandemic hit in March, including some of the Central Valley's most historic theaters. But efforts are taking place to help these landmarks weather the storm. To learn more, I spoke with Lawrence Abbott, CFO of the Tower Theater in Fresno, and Vicky Escobedo, Executive Director of the Fox Theater in Visalia.
So, Lawrence, let's start with you. What is the state of the Tower Theater currently?
Well, we are obviously not doing any shows, but looking at a lot of possibilities that it looks like venues aren't going to be opening until realistically 2021. So what we're looking at is outdoor, obviously the movies. We've done a couple test runs. They came out really nice. We're lucky, blessed that we have a parking lot that will allow, 100 cars. So that seems feasible. And so we're looking at that. we were doing a concert outside following Live Nation's protocols that was, you know, in Europe, they were doing, you get a parking stall and then you get the, if you wanted to buy the one next to you to sit out, then your family or whoever's in the car could take seats and sit right there. So you're basically getting two stalls, one or two. You can stay in the car or you can get out and sit, and it looked really cool. So that's probably the most realistic traction right there. But the city is slow to give us a yes or no. Some are fine, do it. The others are, we, you know, like the city attorney, just can't figure out if they're going to allow it or not. So it's kind of uncharted territory, I feel for them. So that's kind of where we're at, you know. We can't do it because if they don't give us the blessing, we can't spend, you know, 20 grand getting a big show together and then have it canceled, you know, that they shut us down.
And what about employees and layoffs?
There's nobody here really but myself, and there's nothing really to do. I don't think anybody anticipated it being this long, so I don't really know what to do. Just try to wait it out as the best we can and hope there's employees to get when you come back. I'm sure they're going to have to move off to other things. That's going to be the interesting part, is when it does open, who's going to be remaining from staff to agencies, bands, all the above, to call and put on a show.
And Vicky, I would imagine a lot of this sounds familiar in terms of what's going on with the Visalia Fox Theater.
Absolutely. I echo your sentiments, Lawrence, 100%. We're also looking at the possibility of maybe doing something outdoors. We unfortunately don't have a parking lot. We are in the corner streets of downtown Visalia. So, you know, anything that we would do would require any sort of a city permit to close the street. And then, like you said, with regard to the cities, we're not sure exactly, you know, what we'll be allowed to do. And so that's currently where we're at. But we've been shuttered as well since March. And same thing, it's going to look totally different. You know, when it's time to reopen, I expect it would be 2021 at the earliest at this point. You know, a lot of your international touring groups that'll make their way through at the end of the year, you know, for your various holiday shows, they're not touring this year. So you've got different things like that that won't be taking to our stage, certainly. With regard to our staff, same thing. I don't know what that will look like when it's time to come back, how many will have moved on, how many will still be available. So many unknowns. I think we've got nearly 5 months in here at this point. It seems clear, drawing from our past experience thus far, that it's unlikely we'll do anything for the remainder of 2020.
Both of your theaters are living pieces of history that play such a critical role in bringing the performing arts to the Central Valley. Vicky, maybe we could stay with you. What can the community do to support your venue or venues like yours?
Right now, we are obviously reaching out and hoping that Visalia, as she has always done, will continue to rally. We sit just in downtown Visalia, the beautiful downtown of the Diamond of Downtown, as we're called. And we're beginning to hear from people saying, hey, I want to keep the Fox alive and do what I can do. So we're beginning to hear from people now. But I find a lot of people aren't aware that some businesses have not been allowed to open, and they don't realize we have been closed as long as we have been. So obviously, you know, I can assure our community that we are being very wise stewards with that which we've been entrusted. We are a nonprofit organization. And we are at this point relying on donations that we receive from members of the public. And if people want to contribute, foxvisalia.org/donate, we would be most grateful.
And Lawrence, maybe you can speak to what folks in Fresno could do to help the Tower Theater.
Donations are fantastic. And matter of fact, our customers have supported us really well in that. So we're blessed that way. A different thought was all the tickets that we're holding. I don't know if Vicky, you have the same thing, but we had a lot of shows midstream cancel. Kind of a good note was, I would say high 90% of all, everybody wants to keep their ticket. You know, I thought, okay, we're going to have to refund all these tickets. Almost everybody, except for a few that were out of town, other reasons. But that was encouraging. People, we're sitting on still lots of shows and tickets that have just moved to later, even in this year, kind of wishful thinking, but you know, probably 2021, and they're chomping at the bit to come back. So I always get encouraged by that. You know, get down on the news a little bit sometimes and listening to certain things, but the community is ready to go. So that part, I always, mm-hmm. oh man, okay, we're staying in and getting ready to ramp up. But that part is great. Is that the same with you, Vicki?
No, we've had to refund everything at this point. So we don't have any current tickets that we're holding. We are hoping to reschedule a number of shows into 2021, but everything's just on hold at this point.
I think the vaccine's really the ticket, you know, that people will feel comfortable. And that's kind of what I'm thinking is going to do it more than even if they did open up right now, if everybody's the city said, okay, fine, we're opening up everything. I think there's a lot of people just be uncomfortable sitting that close. I mean, that's what we do is close right. contact.
It's part right. of the experience.
Yeah, I know. Sure. It's great. But people appreciate more what we had. There's no doubt. I think all of us on some level just don't think any of us have gone through this type of pandemic. Obviously, it's been well past our time. But that's the good part, too, you know, mm-hmm. if there is. You got to look for the silver lining. So I'm thinking, you know, people appreciate what we have and what we had. And I think the future is going to be good when we get through this and even better.
Yeah, I think at some point the community is definitely looking to come back together. And this is just our venues are the types of places that are certainly those focal points, if you will, where the community gathers and enjoys entertainment, various forms of the arts. So I think at some point people will be ready. I do have concerns about a limited capacity once we are allowed to open and how that will impact, you know, our ability to operate as well. But we will cross that bridge just as we have the last 5 months whenever we get there.
Right, right. We need that vaccine because I don't think at a 25% it really works, you know, just like restaurants. Correct. Theaters, or at least ours is, you know, it's capacity is what makes it.
Correct.
You know, it does 25%. I don't think it's a winning model unless they want to mm-hmm. pay 3-4 times the ticket price. There, you know, another side, I don't know, Vicki, you've been following this, but how agencies and promoters work is really going through quite a change that I hear.
What kind of changes are you seeing?
Let's see. The bands are going to have more in it. You know, typically you would go to an agency, book a band that you thought would do good. They would come with a price. And the venue prices was hard to raise the rent, this, that, and the other. We find ways to try to make more income off of the shows. But that was set. And the bands didn't do a lot of marketing or anything. And if there was one person in there or, you know, 500 or 600, then that was just what it is. But they're really trying to change that structure where everybody has a more equal footing on the success from the venue to the promoter to the agency and the band. And they were, you know, I liked that. I thought that was good because there's a lot of room, it seems like, for negotiation and to be creative in their genres and how they make money. And at the venue, you know, you got your price and your seats and this is it. But, you know, if the band gets involved and says, look, we're going to advertise coming into the place because they really, their social media is so strong. We do a lot of that now, but there's nothing like the band being involved right. and having a little skin in the game. You know, if they're going to charge $15,000 to play, it's like, okay, you know, what else can you do besides show up and play? That's big. We understand that. But if you can, you know, get behind the social media and start getting to all of your fans out there, because the advertising, I think maybe we all agree, is probably the toughest thing, is to get everybody in the Fresno area and surrounding to know that show on that date. It's just difficult. Traditional advertising nets probably 25% of the people. Social media is probably 50% now, and mm-hmm. some other smaller ways to get out to people. But I thought that was great to hear that they're trying to change a system that has been in place probably for well beyond my years. And I thought it needed. So that helps us. That was encouraging for us. I think it'll give us more success in the shows, you know, having more of a turnout. We did pretty good, but nothing like, you know, having a sold out one every time trying to do stuff like that. So that was nice to hear.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
You know, before we wrap up, I would like to talk about what's happening on a federal level to provide potentially some support for independent performing arts venues. Vicki, could you talk a little bit about what's happening there?
Absolutely. The National Independent Venue Association is spearheading efforts to help bring some federal relief to independent venues such as ours that have been essentially shut down. We have plenty of overhead, obviously, with our historic buildings that have to be maintained. But this will certainly help with some of those costs. And I know that people can visit saveourstages.com, and the information's there. Very simple. It doesn't take very much time. We are coming to the end of that, I believe. Time is short. And then there's a little link, and then you can send some letters to your representatives in your area.
Well, On behalf of the entire Central Valley, we wish you all the best. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
All right, Kathleen, thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. For weeks, as the coronavirus has spread, we've been hearing reports of hospitals nearing their capacity. So what happens when they fill up? And what was the bombshell state health officials dropped this week when it comes to COVID-19 data collection? Here to answer those questions is health reporter Carrie Klein with our weekly COVID update. Carrie, thanks for being here.
Hi, Kathleen.
So let's start with a general overview of what's happened in the last week.
Okay, well, so I'm actually going to start with news from the state this week. So yeah, we had some whiplash. You know, it started with some good news from Governor Newsom on Monday. He had said that, you know, 7-day averages of new cases had improved significantly. There had also been a drop in the state's positivity rate. And then on Tuesday, the state's Health and Human Services Agency Secretary Mark Galley took all of that back. He said that there's been a big glitch in the state's case reporting system known as CalReady, and it's likely that case counts and the positivity rate are all higher than currently being reported, that there have been positive cases that have been missed, there have been some delays in processing those positive cases, and that also goes for individual counties, not just the state, and it's unclear how long this has been going on for and how long it'll take to fix. So that being said, it's difficult to know how much we can rely on case counts this week in our area. However, one thing that Galley said is not affected by that glitch is the numbers of people in hospitals and ICU beds. And when it comes to that data, you know, the hospitals in our area are in slightly better shape than last week. ICUs are just as full. And many hospitals are in their ICUs are still at that critical capacity, which is, you know, really quite concerning. And I'll have more information about what that means when hospitals are that full later on in this interview.
Sounds good. And instead of highlights from around the Valley this week, I understand you're just going to give us a few details on one county.
That's right. Usually the best news in our area, for those who listen regularly, it comes from Mariposa County. So I decided to focus a little more on them this week.
Okay, so give us a snapshot of what's been going on there.
All right, so far in the pandemic, they've had 59 positive COVID-19 cases and 2 deaths. That's the lowest case rate of any county in our region. It's one of the lowest in the state. And here's Mariposa County Health Officer, Dr. Eric Sergienko.
So I'm concerned, but I think we're managing it well. You know, we're a small county, 18,000 people, but we only have 2 active cases right now.
And neither of those 2 cases require hospitalization at the moment.
With such small numbers, they must be able to pin down the cause of transmissions there. How is the disease being spread?
So Sergienko referred to the county as, quote, an island of person-to-person spread surrounded by a sea of community transmission. So that's an interesting way of putting it, because the county is pretty isolated. But the origin for a lot of these cases appears to be out of county, either Mariposa residents, they travel out and contract the disease elsewhere, or tourists are bringing it in. And it's an unusual county in this region because it relies so much on tourism. You know, Yosemite National Park is there, they've got national forests and rivers. And Sergienko says that many of the cases are actually coming in from people out of county who have come in to be tourists, and they've caused small outbreaks at some businesses. And of the 2 people in Mariposa County who have died of the disease, one contracted it at a nursing home out of county, and it's believed that the other woman contracted it while traveling out of county as well.
So what are county health officials doing to reduce the spread?
So Mariposa County is not on the state's county monitoring list like all of the other counties in the San Joaquin Valley. So they don't have as many restrictions on businesses as other counties do. Gyms and retail stores are still allowed to be open, but bars are still closed. Restaurants are restricted to outdoor, you know, dining areas only. Schools are allowed to open in person, but Sergienko says that they will likely still begin virtually just to be safe. And then if we talk about, the deaths in the county, you know, two people dying of COVID-19, it's still so much lower than the hundreds in neighboring counties. But Sergienko says there's kind of a real paradox to that low number in such an isolated community.
That's both the nice thing and the tragedy of a small county. Every number means something because you can touch how it works within the matrix of the community. But when you lose someone, it's a very personal tragedy.
And then in terms of other data points, Mariposa County has only one hospital, but they've never hospitalized more than two COVID patients there at any one time. So Sergianko says that hospital is nowhere near capacity. Should cases surge, however, they will have a facility at the ready at the Mariposa County Fairgrounds.
Okay, so I want to turn to those surge sites, like the one you just mentioned at the fairgrounds. What are sites like that used for, and are any of them in use right now?
Right. So the state early on set up a network of what they call alternate care sites. They're big, high capacity facilities that basically are designed to help with overflow from hospitals. And yes, one is in use in our area as we speak, and it's in Porterville. It's at the Porterville Developmental Center. It was activated in June. And I wanted to know a little bit more about it, so I spoke about the site with Carrie Montero. She's a spokesperson with the Tulare County Health and Human Services Agency, and she says the site is for patients who don't need critical care, but they're not ready to go home from the hospital just yet.
The prime example would be that they patients may need oxygen, or they're on the tail end of the rehabilitation in fighting this virus before they are discharged to go home. And the purpose is to get these individuals out of the beds in the hospitals so the hospital can use those beds available for critical care.
The Porterville site is the default site accepting patients throughout the San Joaquin Valley for right now, but should it approach capacity, there are backup sites that can be activated at the Fresno Convention Center and at the fairgrounds in Kern and Mariposa counties.
How big is the Porterville alternate care site?
It's pretty big. It's staffed for 50 beds at the moment, but it has the capacity for up to 150. And when I spoke with Montero earlier this week, there were 14 patients there that day. The site has seen a total of 58 so far since it opened.
Okay, so 14 patients there at one time. That doesn't sound like a lot. Might that be good news?
Not exactly, no.
Okay.
Yeah, unfortunately, no. I mean, it's still an overflow site. And, you know, like I said earlier, hospitals are still close to capacity right now, especially in Tulare County. Here's Montero again.
Looking over the entire pandemic, we are still at those surge capacities because we still have hospitals requesting the use of the alternate care site to send their patients because they're feeling the pressure, particularly in their ICU and acute care facilities.
So she says there's no reason to feel that we're out of the woods just yet.
Well, Carrie, as usual, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Farm workers in the San Joaquin Valley are facing higher risk of contracting COVID-19 compared to non-agricultural industries, according to a new farm workers study. That's on top of dealing with extreme heat and pesticide exposure. FM89's Madi Bolaños put together this audio postcard from farm workers in Wasco about what it's like to perform this essential work during a pandemic.
I started working in the fields in 1995. It's difficult to work now because of social distance and having to wear masks. At around 11 a.m., it starts to get hot and it becomes harder for us to breathe with a mask. We have asked for masks from the company we work for, but they say they aren't ready to distribute them. So I purchased some in Fresno for the workers. There have been less workers now because of the pandemic, but there's still a lot of us who have to work, because if we don't work, we don't have the means to survive.
Ha cambiado mucho porque nos tenemos que cuidar más para no agarrar infecciones.
It's changed a lot because we have to protect ourselves more now from the virus going around. We have to be more careful in all aspects. We have to risk our lives to come to work because we still need to pay rent and other bills. The people who don't have legal documentation risk everything to work because we don't have any government aid, so there's no option besides working. My husband and I are both working in the fields, but we're making less than we would before the pandemic. Because, for example, the garlic we're picking today, it's a lot smaller, so we have to hurry and pick much more to try and earn what we typically earn in a day. A bucket of garlic is $3, so we try to fill around 30 buckets, which amounts to $100 a day. But it's all at the risk of contracting the virus.
It's very bad because most of the workers are afraid to work. But what else can we do? We have to work because if we don't, we won't be able to survive. I've worked in the fields for 32 years. It's the first type of work they show you when you come here. So it's what you do because we have bills to pay. Don't think we do this because the pay is good. We get paid very little. We have to drive 2 hours to get to work to earn $100. It's very little, but we do it because we need it. It's difficult to find other work when you have no documentation. You have no choices but to feel. But we thank God because at least we're working. Here we are working like normal. But we leave our homes at 3 a.m. to get here at 5 a.m. to pick up garlic for $3 a bucket during the pandemic. The only reason we have masks is because either we bring them or our foreman provides them for us. But it's not the company. Right now with the virus, we're scared. We ask God to watch over us every day. It's hard to social distance in the field. We have to work right now for as long as the foreman lets us, because who knows if the virus will stop production completely. I'd like for the companies we work for to higher the prices per bucket, to value the work we do and the risk we take by coming to work every day. I've worked in the fields for over 25 years, and the price for bucket has only increased by 25 to 50 cents.
Now we're going to take you to another part of Kern County, a city in the Mojave Desert. In California City, some say realtors have been selling the false promise of wealth since its inception, and the practice continues today. That's the subject of a new podcast from KPCC's LAist Studios called California City. FM89's Laura Satsui spoke to host and reporter Emily Guerin about the podcast. Before their conversation, here's how Guerin introduces the very first episode.
This was only supposed to be a story about water. But in California, stories about water always end up being about money, power, and deception.
Emily Guerin, thank you for being with us. As we just heard, when you visited California City to report on water back in 2016, that was the initial reason you were there, but then you found a lot of other issues that this podcast kind of unearths. And what was the discovery that made you realize, oh, there's so much more, I need to stick around?
I think it was a couple of things. I mean, first, California City is a really visually striking place. And if you've never been there before, I would just look it up on Google Satellite View. It's like huge and sprawling, and there's like hundreds of miles of roads with no houses. And when you go, it just sort of feels like, okay, this wasn't the way it was supposed to be. Like something happened. Something went wrong. There was clearly some plan here that didn't get executed. So that was sort of intriguing in and of itself. But while I was there working on the story about drought, I met with the former police chief in California City, who kind of is now the town's like de facto historian. And he mentioned to me two things. He mentioned to me that a lot of people thought that the city's developer, so he's the one who paved the roads and built all the water lines and kind of had the vision for the place. A lot of people thought that he actually didn't really intend to build a city, like he was just trying to make as much money as possible. And the whole thing was this like massive, elaborate fraud. And I was like, okay, that's interesting. That had been written about a little bit. But the other thing he mentioned I'd never heard anything about, which was that he thought that this sort of dream that, you know, if you invest now, if you buy land in California City, it's going to be worth something someday, that dream was still being sold today by this company called Silver Saddle Ranch and Club. And that just seemed kind of remarkable to me that this very sort of like gold rush era, like boostery dream would still be sold today and would actually still be compelling enough that people would buy into it. So that's kind of why I wanted to look into this more. And that's kind of what ended up sort of prompting me to decide, okay, I think this could be a podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I was thinking one group of people that I haven't heard from yet in the podcast are those who live there. We've heard from people who bought land, people who are being convinced to buy land, and people who sell land. And so when you were there, I mean, what did they think about you digging so deeply into the city's past for this podcast?
Well, so in the second full episode, there are a number of people I talked to who are sort of moved to the city many years ago and are still residents. And then in the episode that comes out in 2 weeks, it's actually all about kind of like contemporary California City and kind of the culture of the place and like what it is about this town such that this sort of quote unquote open secret of, you know, what Silver Saddle Ranch and Club was doing could kind of be known by so many people, but they could kind of continue operating for so long. Reporting in California City was really interesting. I rented a house there with my colleague, James Kim, and we probably went like 5 or 6 times, and I think we spent about 3 weeks there total. But the largest chunk was this like 2-week block where we were just like living in the city, you know, shopping for groceries there, like going out to eat. And it was this sort of like strange dance we were doing a lot of the time where we knew we really wanted to ask people about Silver Saddle and about like the legacy of land sales in the city. But we also knew it was like a very sensitive topic. And we learned pretty quickly that people didn't want to talk about it. Or at least they didn't want to talk about it on the record. And there was this sort of fear people had of being seen as someone who would talk to a reporter about this company that maybe they thought was suspicious, but they didn't know for sure. Like people didn't want to be viewed as like a snitch. There was a lot of people who told us, you know, variations on, this is a really small town. Everybody knows everybody. You know, you don't understand. You don't have to live here. Like, my kids are in school here. Like, I can't talk to you about this. Or I own a business here. I've lived in rural America basically like a lot of my adult life before moving to Los Angeles, including like North Dakota and rural Colorado. And so like I know what it's like to live in a small town and to feel like there's just so much at stake that you can't, even if you know something's going wrong, you really feel like you can't risk it. And that's what I felt in California City.
So here I want to play a clip from one of your sources, Catherine Efford, where she basically like gives you the pitch for investing in California City.
California City is sandwiched between 3 major freeways. They will someday be 6 and 8 lane freeways. Today, that's not quite there. But where California City is what will give her value. If you can't see the vision, you can't see the dream, don't buy it. If all you see is vacant land with a few roads, you don't get it. If you see another Van Nuys or another Encino or another Salt Lake City, then you've got the vision. If you've got the vision, buy it. If you don't have the vision, don't bother.
What was going through your head when she gave you that pitch?
Yeah, oh my God. So Catherine Efford, she still lives in California City. She, I think, of all the people I talked to, was like the most compelling, like mesmerizing talker. And I Catherine, if you're listening, I really mean that with respect. Like, you're a very good saleswoman. And when she was giving me this pitch, so this is the pitch she used to give. She worked for Nat Mendelsohn's company, Great Western Cities. So this is not the contemporary sales pitch. This is the one that was given in like the 60s and 70s. And she just had it down. I was like, Catherine, can you give me the pitch? And she's like, oh, yeah, under 4 minutes, time me. And I was like, okay. So,
and she's like an older woman now, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah, she's in her 80s, I believe, now. But like extremely sharp, extremely quick, like, you know, just very impressive, like persuasive person. And I think when she was giving me the pitch, it's like, as a radio reporter, sometimes, you know, we talk about this thing called like radio gold. Like that's what it was like for me when Catherine was giving me the pitch. I felt like I couldn't look away. I couldn't stop listening. And I was just like, oh my God, she is so good at this. So it was, on the one hand, like as a reporter, I was very excited. As like a regular person consumer, I was also like, wow. Like, she's a good salesperson.
You know, some of the ways these realtors sold land made me think of, like, my feelings around multi-level marketing, where I hear yeah. something that sounds like that. My gut reaction is like, ooh, I don't know. I have some apprehension. But as you've said, and as the podcast, you know, chronicles, like, these practices sort of happened back in when Nat Mendelsohn built the city and even today. And so how do sort of the governments around California City, like Kern County and just like other communities, perceive this practice and accept it and still think it's fine?
So I think that there's kind of two entities. There's like California City and then there's like Kern County. And in California City, one thing people told me over and over was there's this kind of like good old boys mentality. Like the city, there's people in the city who are very influential, who've lived there for a very long time. A lot of people told me that they just have the sense that like there are powerful men that kind of like run the city and they sort of decide what happens there. And if they don't want some development to happen, it won't. Or if they don't want people to really know about or investigate something, like that thing won't be investigated. So that culture, I feel, played into kind of the perpetuation of this dream being sold. That plus like the fear so many people had in talking about it because it was a small town. And also the city is very under-resourced. The police department at various times has had like 7 officers and they just don't have time to do these kinds of investigations. Or like I mentioned, there might have been political pressure not to do these kinds of big investigations. In Kern County itself, it's kind of different. I mean, when I was in Bakersfield talking to the like tax collector and the tax assessor and some of the district attorneys, there was just this sense that like California City is the other side of the mountain. Like it's kind of the back 40 of Kern County and people mm-hmm. maybe don't pay as much attention to what goes on. Also, there was this sense that like, oh, everybody knows that's how California City is. Like everybody knows that there's like weird land sales happening and it's been going on forever. And, you know, as far as we know, it's not illegal, or maybe it's not our job to figure out if it's illegal or not. So, but yeah, it was really striking when I went to the Kern County tax assessor, like every person I talked to that day knew what was going on.
Oh, wow.
Like knew that people were buying very overpriced land and had been for decades. And it was just kind of like, well, that's what goes on out in the desert.
Emily Guerin, thank you so much for speaking with us. Emily is a reporter at KPCC and host of LAist's California City podcast, which is more than halfway through its 8-episode series. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Emily, thanks again. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. And we'd love to hear from you, especially your experiences around the pandemic. Send us a voice memo on our app. Just hit the audience feedback icon and record. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Laura Satsui, Carrie Klein, and Madi Bolaños. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.